From Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen,
laugh,
learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Quite brilliant. Despite your mental illness, quite resilient. Fight with wit and right, it's real volatility. Low stability, don't let vulnerability lower your agility. This moment is pivotal. Crucial critical, our opponent is intentional. Brutally criminal, to be truthful, our response has been useful and pitiful. Community defense happens when we control the city, though. Perversity, virtually, worshiping emergencies, a constant state of urgency. Crisis creates currency, mass murder and the mayhem, massacres and strife. Manufacturing the chaos, the fascist race is right. Merchants peddle weaponry and sell it to all sides. No guarantees with no tranquility after we all die. Hostility, rage and anger killing me. Make them in atrocities, plausible deniability. We must achieve the impossible, believe in our abilities. I'ma look to you and me, not Hollywood or Hillary. Politicians and police, can't keep the bourgeoisie. Liberation's closer than you think, but y'all ain't really feeling me. It's time to think fast. The movement, learn lessons from my past. The movement, organize the class.
The movement,
solidarity at last.
The movement,
and yo, it's time to think fast.
We are very fortunate to be joined today by Gio Maher. He is the author, most recently, of A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. And that's his fifth book. His other books have included We Created Chavez, Decolonizing Dialectics, Building the Commune, Spirals of Revolt. Gio, thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And what an incredible book. Kianga Yamada Taylor says, this is the right book at the right time. A World Without Police. We've all been having these conversations over the last year and a half, after the killing of George Floyd and the massive protests that erupted around the country. And let's start by talking a little bit about the reason for our police. You go into this in your book about that police and the punitive system of large-scale incarceration is not as many people think to prevent crime, and in fact, it doesn't actually prevent crime. And I wonder if you can just start by talking a little about that.
Certainly. You know, it's really incredible that even to this day, we assume and we're taught, you know, and it's repeated every day, that the police exist to keep communities safe, to prevent crime, to protect and to serve. And yet, what's interesting is that that was never the purpose of the police. They were not created to do so. They emerged out of the sort of dual imperative to, on the one hand, protect private property and wealth, and on the other hand, to police slaves and other, you know, troublesome communities in particular, in part to make sure that, you know, that these communities would function as a dependable labor force. This was the function of the police. And of course, origins don't determine function in the present, but it doesn't take much observation to see that that's precisely what the police do today, that they respond to the interests of those with property on the one hand, and that they respond to the interests of those who bear that, you know, most peculiar kind of property as well, which is whiteness. They seek to, you know, uphold segregation that is both economic and racial, and that, you know, that has not changed in the century since the emergence of the modern police. And what's really shocking, you know, and the real question is, why do we still think that this is what they do? We have all of the statistical proof in the world that the police do not prevent crime. We know, especially when you add that to the fact that they soak billions of dollars out of municipal, state, and federal budgets nationwide, that they are removing funds that could be dedicated to making more egalitarian and safer communities. The real question is, why do we still believe in the police as an alternative and as an option for building safe communities when they have always systematically failed at doing so?
This challenge to the police and the them not actually doing what we believe that they do is not a new thing. I mean, I learned some things in your book about even in the Eisenhower administration that a federal task force investigated police and found that the problem lies much deeper, and it is in the white supremacist basis of both police and our society. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that history and the challenges to policing as a system.
Certainly, and policing has always been more than uniformed police. That's especially important in the U.S. context, where we're talking about the direct overlap between even official police and institutions like the slave patrols, and more specifically, informal institutions of white terror like the Klan. These have always operated hand in hand, and this has not changed in the present either. We know today that police are, you know, make up heavy, you know, large numbers of the membership of overtly white supremacist organizations like the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, the, you know, Proud Boys. The overlap is significant. And while some would argue that this has shown and proves that white supremacists have infiltrated the police as well as the military, the reality is that both the police and the military are themselves incubators for white supremacy. Again, this goes right back to their function. If you're a sort of resentful, you know, patriarchal, misogynistic white dude, what better job, you know, could you choose, you know, than one that allows you to do that every day in uniform?
When you talk about the police and their violence, both in uniform and out of uniform, I was especially struck by your chapter, Who Do You Serve, Who Do You Protect, where you talk about the argument that is often made, well, if we get rid of police and if we get rid of prisons, what are we going to do with rapists? And I wonder, that example of Daniel Holdsclaw, I think, really exemplifies that argument that you make, that in fact the police are not protecting women in any way.
Absolutely. And again, this goes really all the way back. You know, in the aftermath of abolition, white women in particular were sort of strong-armed into a deal with the patriarchy, which said, essentially, if you don't accept our patriarchal authority, we will not protect you from these violent, dangerous, you know, black men in particular. And it was always a devil's bargain. It was always a false kind of liberation and a false deal offered to white women. And yet you see the same thing repeated today, which is the constant injunction that says, well, if you don't have the police, if you get rid of the police, then who will, you know, who will deal with the rapists and the sexual abusers? Who will protect women? We know, and here there's two sides of the ledger. On the one hand, we know absolutely and without a doubt that policing does almost nothing whatsoever to protect women. Even if we thought that convicting people, sentencing them, sending them away to prison, actually played a role in making society safer for women, which it does not. But even if we believe that, the number of sexual abusers who are actually sentenced and sent to jail is tiny. It's, you know, something around 1%. Why? Because it's very difficult to even report sexual assault. If you report it, it's rarely taken seriously. The case of 200,000 untested rape kits sitting on shelves nationwide, which shows you exactly how much the police care about actually, you know, dealing with these cases. On the flip side, you see very clearly that the police enact far more violence on women than they actually prevent, both in uniform, where police systematically target the most vulnerable, not just women in general, but queer and trans people, sex workers, and extort them or abuse them violently. This is, you know, this is endemic. And Daniel Holtzclaw, who, you know, who abused dozens of women and who was actually convicted in a rare case, is exemplary of this phenomenon. And then we can't forget, on top of that, the massive amounts of abuse of women that police carry out out of uniform, at home, where some 40% of police officers, according to the best studies, self-report engaging in domestic violence. That's them saying themselves that they have been violent toward their partners or toward their children. 40%, that's higher than any other occupation. We're looking at police as an incubator for violence, not only against people of color and other vulnerable people, but against women in particular.
And when we think about police as perpetrators of violence, I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about the police responses to the protests that have gone on in this past year in the midst of just brutal police attacks, not just on the people that the protesters are saying, you know, that these were horrible events, but on the protesters themselves.
Yes, I mean, this should be no surprise whatsoever. Again, this is not simply a question of police, you know, being violent toward protesters, abstractly understood. These were specifically protests against the police. They were specifically protests that challenged police power and sought to push back on it. And so they were targeted in even more specific and brutal ways. From the very beginning, we know that in Minneapolis, police were, as they put it, strategically deflating tires. In other words, they were slashing the tires of cars that they thought belonged to protesters. We saw even more recent reports showing that they were, in their own words, hunting protesters during these demonstrations nationwide. We saw the repressive use of violence nationwide. We saw that this extended from local police to state police up to the federal level and to ICE officers. Portland, of course, saw a great deal of this violence, and so I think I'd probably be preaching to the choir in talking about it. Again, we always need to bear in mind the flip side, which is that not only were the police themselves repressing protesters, but they were turning a blind eye to white nationalist violence. They were facilitating that violence. They were out there high-fiving the Kyle Rittenhouses of the world, who were then going out and mowing down and murdering protesters. Because, again, we're talking about this conjunction of white supremacist organizing and the police, not two separate forces, but two forces that have always been intertwined. And we saw that more clearly than ever before last year.
Well, and yet a lot of the things that are being proposed, even here in Portland, basically are reforms. There is a big celebration that we now have in the city of Portland, a citizen police oversight board that actually has teeth to do something. You make the argument that these things are not actually helpful and may be harmful to the cause of abolition, which is where the focus needs to be. And I wonder, can you address that? What's the problem with reforming the police?
I mean, the first problem is that the police are the product of reform. The police themselves embody reform, and we have seen nothing but reform since the foundation of the modern police. The same, you know, people, Angela Davis has pointed this out with regard to prisons as well. The prison, the penitentiary, was the product of reformers who thought that they were doing something better, something modernizing, and, you know, by professionalizing these institutions of repression, and they've led us exactly to where we are today. Policing, you know, has seen waves of reform in the 1880s and 90s, 1920s and 30s, especially in the civil rights era of the 1960s, and then again over this past cycle of struggle since particularly 2014. Across those waves of reform, you see almost entirely, you know, the same package and menu of reforms. Most of these reforms do nothing to change the way that police operate. And the actual goal and the objective, if you read, for example, Obama's 21st century policing report, the objective of the reforms is never, it's never even stated to be about changing. It's always about changing the way police are seen. In other words, increasing their legitimacy. And of course, this involves a whole bunch of what are essentially public relations exercises. You know, and we know, I think, some of the main reforms, but it's worth maybe laying some of them out here. Body cameras do not prevent or reduce police violence. Some studies have shown that they increase it because the police can then use that footage to defend themselves and defend their actions. Training does not help. The police are highly trained. Derek Chauvin was highly trained and was training others. The cop that murdered Rayshard Brooks in a Wendy's in Atlanta just a couple months later had 2,000 hours of training in use of force, in cultural sensitivity, and that didn't stop him from becoming a murderer as well. Training is not the problem. And as Mariam Kaba and others have put it, fundamentally, any reform that proposes putting more money and more resources into policing is a reform that we should oppose. Most reforms, even beyond that, are also, the goal, of course, is to increase the legitimacy of the police. That we should also oppose. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't any shifts that we wouldn't support, any small changes that might open up broader possibilities. And specifically, the question should always be one of what kind of changes will weaken the police, will roll back their power, and will reduce their opportunity to interact with communities. And so defunding, of course, it's been used and abused. It's been, used in incredibly misleading ways. But real defunding is something that, of course, we should support because it withdraws police from communities and it allows abolitionists to say, look, our communities are safer. And as a result of there being fewer police on the street, then we don't need more. Any other proposals essentially that weaken the police, and oversight boards are a really tricky one because almost uniformly they have no power. Almost uniformly, they still rely on the will of the police and the police chiefs who make the final decision. In cases where there are real civilian oversight boards with, subpoena power, with, real powers, to oversee and withhold the power of the police, of course, these are things we should take seriously. That's just an incredibly rare, reality.
And I want to talk about the vision that you have in your book, Geo Maher, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. A world without police is something that I think a lot of people have a hard time envisioning, having lived so many generations with police as the ones to call when something goes wrong in the community. And I know you gave a lot of examples in your book from the Zapatistas to Venezuela, where people are organizing alternatives to the police. But what would that look like here, say, in my neighborhood, where there are shootings every night, and the police, they don't help the situation, but people think that this is who we should call. How do we address that and come together as a community to build an alternative structure?
Yeah, this is a fundamental question, not only in terms of what we can do and what alternatives exist, but the way that the world of police, basically blocks out all other possibilities. I call the world we live in, the world we inhabit, fundamentally a world of police, because it's a world in which we've been told, and it's repeated over and over again, that the police are the only solution for any problem, for mental health crises, for lack of, youth funding, for after school activities. The police are sent in to sort of handle these problems. And we're taught that that is the only solution that exists. That is an incredibly daunting, horizon to resist. It's difficult for us to even think beyond that because our world is actually structured in a way where if something's going on and someone is in danger or someone is feeling vulnerable, they don't really have good options. That's the way that the world is designed, so that we have to call the police. And that's part of the, the difficulty that we need to understand from the very beginning. But I mean, you ask about, your block, you ask about local neighborhoods. And I think that's exactly where these questions, should begin. Of course, we should be pushing back on broader national police power, pushing back on the ideology of policing and the arguments that are made in the media, for example, pushing back on local leadership and trying to create spaces and weaken police power on a municipal, local, state level. But it's really something that is going to be built from the bottom up, right? What happens in your neighborhood when there's a conflict that is bordering on violence? who can step in and de-escalate that? What kind of, you know, of rapid response network or, you know, little text thread between neighbors could be established so that, for example, first of all, if the police are in your neighborhood, neighbors can show up and make sure they aren't abusing people, film them, videotape them, make them feel unwelcome. But that same kind of network is precisely the kind of building block for the obsolescence of police. In other words, a world in which we actually don't need the police because neighbors can step in. Neighbors can de-escalate. Neighbors who take, you know, the people on the block seriously as members of the community, valuable members, as nieces, nephews, cousins, are precisely the ones that need to be helping to de-escalate these conflicts. That is how the world without police builds and develops. It plugs in from that level with a whole range of neighborhood community organizations, social welfare organizations, violence intervention organizations, sexual assault, you know, survivors networks and organizations. All of these different levels of community organizing can build part of this sort of broader abolitionist fabric that we need to continue to expand at the same time that we're fighting police power.
And how does that play out, or how has it played out in places where communities have organized outside of the police structure, like in Caracas or in Chiapas?
I mean, all these examples are very difficult to generalize because they emerge from very specific moments and struggles and histories. You know, of course, in the U.S., we have the legacy of the Black Power struggle and its own claims and demands for self-defense, community self-determination, community control. And these share a great deal, as I argue in the book, with experiments in Mexico, in South Africa, in Caracas, in Northern Ireland, for alternatives to the police. In many cases, though, what I try to argue is, because we hear those arguments sometimes, that it's the most vulnerable that need the police the most. It's the most vulnerable that can't risk a world without policing, because that would mean a world in which violence prevails. This is a wrong argument and a false narrative from the very beginning, because as we know, first of all, the police do not prevent violence. They do not make society safer. But second of all, as we see in places like Mexico, as we see in places like Caracas, you've got situations where it's precisely those most vulnerable communities who are pushed to the brink, who have no alternatives, who recognize and know very well that the police do not make their communities safer, that have pushed the police out entirely. You know, you've got communities that I studied in Caracas that have been living without police for, 50 years almost, and they've been autonomously self-governed and self-determined communities.
So for people wanting to take action, we're finding ways to diminish the power of the police. The police unions is one that you mentioned or that you go into some depth about, and building community power at the same time. And I wonder if you can give some practical steps to people who are interested in moving our society in this direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned police unions. I argue in the book the police unions are really so-called unions. I should say they're fake unions. They're not real unions because police are not workers. But these organizations are the sort of most fascistic spearhead of police power. They're the ones who are constantly expanding in a really sneaky way that most people don't recognize, pushing and expanding the power of the police, their impunity. They're writing into local collective bargaining agreements with your city, agreements that make it almost impossible to hold police responsible for the murders and the violence that they commit. They are passing state laws called Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which make it almost impossible to hold police accountable. And on the national level, they're pushing the country to the right. We're talking about the Border Patrol Union, the ICE Union, and the Fraternal Order of Police as Trump's most right-wing supporters, not even, people that, support and follow Trump, but people that want Trump to be, that wanted Trump to be even more reactionary and even more fascistic than he already was. This is what police organizations and associations do. And so one of the best things we can do is to throw them out of union federations, make sure that they cannot organize, reveal them for what they are, protest as people are doing in Philly all the time, organize against the collective bargaining agreement between the Fraternal Order of Police and the city to try to make it impossible for the FOP to have these closed door, discussions and agreements that are binding, on the city. Those are all offensive measures that we can take. And that goes absolutely hand in hand with these preemptive and creative prefigurative strategies to build the kind of institutions that we need to make police obsolete. both of those pieces are, you know, are happening in your city. You know, whether it's, you know, Minneapolis, which is still, you know, voting in a ballot initiative to try to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department, but where simultaneously it's going to be necessary for people on the ground to push to make sure that whatever institution might replace the police does not simply become, you know, the police again. Because this is the real difficult thing about abolition, that we need to change all of these institutions. We need to abolish white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, and the police at the same time. And that's incredibly difficult. It requires working on all these different levels at once, because you could abolish the police tomorrow, and what you would have immediately would be a whole bunch of private police to protect the wealthy, and to police segregation in the boundaries of the city. That's not what we want. What we need is to sort of, you know, walk on two legs at once, dismantling police, you know, prisons and other repressive institutions at the same time that we're building community alternatives.
And I know you kind of went into this a little bit, but how do people build community alternatives? Is it just like talking to your neighbors? Is it connecting with organizations? What are some of the ways that people can do, and who to call when there is an incident of violence? How do we build that kind of resiliency in our communities that people have an alternative to call at times of crisis?
Yeah, and I think it's all of those things at once. As I said, I think in most people's communities, this work is already going on. There are places to plug in. There are also always new initiatives that can be started. You know, in Oregon, you know, saw the birth of what's called the CAHOOTS model of 911 call diversion for mental health crises, which does not send police and which instead sends intervention teams. That model has become, you know, one of the main ones nationwide. And after the George Floyd rebellions, more than 100 municipalities reached out to the organization to try to talk about implementing that model locally. These are the kind of things that can be pushed. You can plug into local community centers and local community you know, organizations that are building, you know, kind of abolitionist spaces and abolitionist frameworks. And again, of course, you need to be building with neighbors, building on a local level, raising awareness at the same time that you're speaking and organizing about, you know, who precisely could be called. You know, sometimes when the question is raised as who do we call when there's violence or when there's conflict on our in our neighborhoods, unfortunately, part of the answer has to be ourselves. Part of the answer has to be the neighbors themselves being willing and able to step up to say, listen, we're not going to invite the police into our communities. We're going to prevent this violence before it even begins. And there are organizations doing that nationwide.
Well, and that's not unfortunate. I mean, that's what we need to step into as part of civic responsibility. I think it's kind of a new step
for
some folks. I want to thank you, Gio Maher, for joining us today. Again, Gio Maher is the author of the new book, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. It's been released from Verso Publishing, and I'm guessing people can find it at Powell's at this point and other booksellers, Gio?
Yes, I think they can. You get it online from Verso directly. Sometimes it's on sale even, and you know, please check it out and let me know what you think.
All right, and that website is versobooks.com, versobooks.com. Thanks again, Gio, for being with us on KBOO today. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.
Going. Now, I dialed 911 a long time ago. Don't you see how late they're reacting? They only come and they come when they wanna. So get the morgue truck and then bomb the corner. They don't care because they stay paid anyway. They treat you like an ace that can't beat the tray. I know you stumble with no use people. If your life is on the line, then you're dead today. Latecomers with the latecomers stretcher. That's a body bag in disguise, y'all. I'll bet ya. I call them body snatchers because they come to fetch you with an autopsy ambulance just to dissect ya. They are the kings because they swing amputations. Lose your arms, your legs, and them is compilation. I can prove it to you, watch the rotation. It all adds up to a f***ing situation. So get up and get down. 911 is joking, yo, town. Get up and get down. Late 911, where's the late crown? Get up and get down. 911 is joking, yo, town. Get up and get down. Late 911, where's the late crown? Correct. You can ask my man right here with the broken neck.
doctors huddle up and call a flea flicker. Reason why I say that, cause they flick you up like fleas. They be laughing at you while you're crawling on your knees or to the stream, so don't a limp, thinking you are first when you really are dim. You better wake up and smell a real flavor, cause 911 is a fake lifesaver. So get up and get down. 911 is joking your town. Get up and get down. Late 911, where's the late crown? Get up and get down. 911 is joking your town. Get up and get down. Late 911, where's the late crown?
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Today on Wings, Feminist Foreign Policy, The Next Generation.
Anything that is under the banner of feminism is really about challenging hierarchies and aiming for social and political transformation.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Back in 2011, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was lauded in The Guardian for proving that a feminist foreign policy is possible. She took up issues ranging from including women in negotiations with the Taliban.